Chapter 13. Falk was about to go on deck and have it out at once when he remarked that one of the ports of his cabin commanded the approaches to the freshwater pump. Instead of going out, he remained in and secured the door. "He best man shall survive," he said to himself, and the other he reasoned must at some time or other come there to drink. These starving men would drink often to cheat the pangs of their hunger. But the carpenter too must have noticed the position of the port. They were the two best men in the ship, and the game was with them. All the rest of the day Falk saw no one and heard no sound. At night he strained his eyes. It was dark. He heard a rustling noise once, but he was certain that no one could have come near the pump. It was to the left of his deck port, and he could not have failed to see a man, for the night was clear and starry. He saw nothing. Towards morning another faint noise made him suspicious. Deliberately and quietly he unlocked his door. He had not slept, and had not given way to the horror of the situation. He wanted to live. But during the night the carpenter, without at all trying to approach the pump, had managed to creep quietly along the starboard bulwark, and, unseen, had crouched down right under Falk's deck port. When daylight came he rose up suddenly, looked in, and putting his arm through the round brass-framed opening, fired at Falk within a foot. He missed, and Falk, instead of attempting to seize the arm holding the weapon, opened his door unexpectedly, and with the muzzle of his long revolver nearly touching the other's side, shot him dead. The best man had survived. Both of them had at the beginning just strength enough to stand on their feet, and both had displayed pitiless resolution, endurance, cunning and courage, all the qualities of classic heroism. At once Falk threw overboard the captain's revolver. He was a born monopolist. Then after the report of the two shots, followed by a profound silence, there crept out into the cold, cruel dawn of Antarctic regions, from various hiding places, over the deck of that dismantled corpse of a ship floating on a gray sea ruled by iron necessity, and with a heart of ice, there crept into view one by one, cautious, slow, eager, glaring, and unclean, a band of hungry and livid skeletons. Falk faced them, the possessor of the only firearm on board, and the second best man, the carpenter, was lying dead between him and them. "He was eaten, of course," I said. He bent his head slowly, shuddered a little, drawing his hands over his face, and said, "I had never any quarrel with that man. But there were our lives between him and me. Why continue the story of that ship, that story before which, with its freshwater pump like a spring of death, its man with the weapon, the sea ruled by iron necessity, its spectral band swayed by terror and hope, its mute and unhearing heaven, the fable of the Flying Dutchman with its conventine of crime, and its sentimental retribution fades like a graceful wreath, like a wisp of white mist. What is there to say that every one of us cannot guess for himself?" I believe Falk began by going through the ship, revolver in hand, to annex all the matches. Those starving wretches had plenty of matches. He had no mind to have the ship set on fire under his feet, either from hate or from despair. He lived in the open, camping on the bridge, commanding all the after deck, and the only approach to the pump. He lived. Some of the others lived too, concealed, anxious, coming out one by one from their hiding places at the seductive sound of a shot. And he was not selfish. They shared, but only three of them all were alive when a whaler, returning from her cruising ground, nearly ran over the waterlogged hull of the Borgmester Doll, which, it seems, in the end had in some way sprung a leak in both her holds, but being loaded with deals could not sink. "They all died," Falk said. "He's three too, afterwards. But I would not die. All died, all. Under this terrible misfortune. But was I to throw away my life? Could I? Tell me, Captain. I was alone there, quite alone, just like the others. Each man was alone. Was I to give up my revolver? Who to? Or was I to throw it into the sea? What would have been the good? Only the best man would survive. It was a great, terrible, and cruel misfortune. He had survived. I saw him before me, as though preserved for a witness to the mighty truth of an unerring and eternal principle. Great beads of perspiration stood on his forehead. And suddenly it struck the table with a heavy blow, as he fell forward throwing his hands out. "And this is worse," he cried. "This is a worse pain. This is more terrible." He made my heart thump with the profound conviction of his cries. And after he had left me alone, I called up before my mental eye the image of the girl weeping silently, abundantly, patiently, and as if irresistibly. I thought of her tawny hair. I thought how, if unplaited, it would have covered her all round as low as the hips, like the hair of a siren. And thus he had bewitched him. Fancy a man who would guard his own life with the inflexibility of a pitiless and immovable fate, being brought to lament that once a crowbar had missed his skull. The siren sing, and lure to death, but this one had been weeping silently, as if for the pity of his life. She was the tender and voiceless siren of this appalling navigator. He evidently wanted to live his whole conception of life. Nothing else would do. And she too was a servant of that life that, in the midst of death, cries aloud to our senses. She was eminently fitted to interpret for him its feminine side. And in her own way, and with her own profusion of sensuous charms, she also seemed to illustrate the eternal truth of an unerring principle. I don't know, though, what sort of principle Herman illustrated, when he turned up early on board my ship with a most perplexed air. It struck me, however, that he too would do his best to survive. He seemed greatly calmed on the subject of fog, but still very full of it. "What is it you said I was last night?" "You know," he asked after some preliminary talk. "Tutu, I don't know. A very funny word."
"Squeamish?"
I suggested.
"Yes."
"What does it mean?"
"That you exaggerate things to yourself. Without inquiry, and so on."
He seemed to turn it over in his mind. We went on talking. This fog was the plague of his life. Upsetting everybody like this. Mrs. Herman was unwell rather this morning. His niece was crying still. There was nobody to look after the children. He struck his umbrella on the deck. She would be like that for months. Fancy carrying all the way home, second class, a perfectly useless girl who is crying all the time. It was bad for Lena too, he observed. But on what grounds I could not guess. Perhaps of the bad example. That child was already sorrowing and crying enough over the rag doll. Nicholas was really the least sentimental person of the family. "Why does she weep?" I asked.
"From pity," cried Herman.
It was impossible to make out women. Mrs. Herman was the only one he pretended to understand. She was very, very upset and doubtful.
"Doubtful about what?" I asked.
He averted his eyes, and did not answer this. It was impossible to make them out. For instance, his niece was weeping for fog. Now he, her man, would like to wring his neck, but then. He supposed he had too tender a heart.
"Ranglai," he asked at last, "what do you think of what we heard last night, Captain?"
"In all these tales," I observed, "there is always a good deal of exaggeration." And not letting him recover from his surprise, I assured him that I knew all the details. He begged me not to repeat them. His heart was too tender. They made him feel unwell. Then, looking at his feet and speaking very slowly, he supposed that he need not see much of them after they were married. For, indeed, he could not bear the sight of fog. On the other hand, it was ridiculous to take home a girl with her head turned. A girl that weeps all the time and is of no help to her aunt. "Now you will be able to do with one cabin only on your passage home," I said.
"Yes, I had thought of that," he said brightly, almost.
"S. Himself, his wife, four children, one cabin might do. Whereas if his niece went.
And what does Mrs. Herman say to it?" I inquired. Mrs. Herman did not know whether a man of that sort could make a girl happy, as he had been greatly deceived in Captain Fogg, as he had been very upset last night. Those good people did not seem to be able to retain an impression for a whole 12 hours. I assured him on my own personal knowledge that Fogg possessed in himself all the qualities to make his niece's future prosperous. He said he was glad to hear this, and that he would tell his wife. Then the object of the visit came out. He wished me to help him to resume relations with Fogg. His niece, he said, had expressed the hope I would do so in my kindness. He was evidently anxious that I should, for though he seemed to have forgotten 9/10 of his last night's opinions, and the whole of his indignation, yet he evidently feared to be sent to the right about. Who told me he was very much in love, he concluded slyly, and leered in a sort of bucolic way. As soon as he had left my ship, I called Fogg on board by signal, the tug still lying at the anchorage. He took the news with calm gravity, as though he had all along expected the stars to fight for him in their courses. I saw them once more together, and only once, on the quarter deck of the Diana. Herman sat smoking with a shirt-sleeved elbow hooked over the back of his chair. Mrs. Herman was sewing alone. As Fogg stepped over the gangway, her man's niece, with a slight swish of the skirt and a swift friendly nod to me, glided past my chair. They met in sunshine abreast of the mainmast. He held her hands and looked down at them, and she looked up at him with her candid and unseeing glance. It seemed to me they had come together as if attracted, drawn, and guided to each other by a mysterious influence. They were a complete couple. In her gray frock, palpitating with life, generous of form, Olympian and simple, she was indeed the siren to fascinate that dark navigator, this ruthless lover of the five senses. From afar I seemed to feel the masculine strength with which he grasped those hands as he had extended to him with a womanly swiftness. Lena, a little pale, nursing her beloved lump of dirty rags, ran towards her big friend. And then in the drowsy silence of the good old ship, Mrs. Herman's voice rang out so changed that it made me spin round in my chair to see what was the matter. "Lena, come here," she screamed. And this good-natured matron gave me a wavering glance, dark and full of fearsome distrust. The child ran back, surprised, to her knee. But the two, standing before each other in sunlight with clasped hands, had heard nothing, had seen nothing and no one. 3 feet away from them in the shade, a seaman sat on a spar, very busy splicing a strop and dipping his fingers into a tar pot, as if utterly unaware of their existence. When I returned in command of another ship, some 5 years afterwards, Mr. and Mrs. Falk had left the place. I should not wonder if Schomburg's tongue had succeeded at last in scaring Falk away for good. And, indubitably, there was a tale still going about the town of a certain Falk, owner of a tug, who had won his wife at cards from the captain of an English ship. The end. End of the Project Gutenberg text of Falk, by Joseph Conrad. FALK 1 by Gutenberg Edition.